You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Buongiorno. Today we are going to repeat an interview Gary Foley and myself did on Radical Australia with Angelo Grando on September 2013. Why replay this interview? I think it's important that we replay some of the most interesting chats we've done. And unfortunately, in those days, we didn't podcast the program, but somebody found a tape and a CD. Not a tape, it was a post-tape CD. And we felt it was important that we shared this with our listeners. Angelo was a great human being, and all great human beings need to be remembered.
Well, my friends are gone and my hair is grey. I ache in the places where I used to play, and I'm crazy.
Good afternoon, folks. This is Gary Foley and
Joe Toscano
bringing you Radical Australia for yet another week. And this week, our unsuspecting guest is an old friend of mine, probably my oldest friend in Melbourne, one of the first people I met in Melbourne when I moved down here 40 years ago. His name's Angelo Grando. Good evening, afternoon, Angelo.
Thank you, Gary. Good evening. And how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Now, Joe will ask the questions.
Como sta? Como sta, ragazzo? Como sta?
Benissimo, compagno.
Bene. Excuse. Tedesca.
Tedesca.
Sì.
Tedesca. Sono brava gente.
Brava gente, sì.
Non facciamo scherzi.
No.
I can turn your microphones off if you refuse to speak in English.
Per favore, no parlo italiano.
Oh, bravo, Gary, bravo. Perfetto.
Now, we usually ask a boring question, but I'd like to ask you an interesting question. We usually ask, you know, what's your first bloody recollection? We'll ask you that later, but how did you meet this disreputable man?
Well, that's I'll tell question. You. Was.
This is Angelo's.
No. Gary came sort of after I met our best friend, Bruce McGuinness. Both mine and his, I think. And that was in 1972, I was living with a bunch of people out at Monash, and I came home one night from working in a factory. I took off a year. And there in Coonawarra Street, he's sitting this chappie in a beanbag. We only had beanbags then. And there's Bruce McGuinness in the beanbag. And I was introduced to him by, I think, Jim Rendevsky or Lenny Hartnett. And we sat down, I think we spoke for about 5 hours. He told me he was part Italian too, Bruce. We got our house on fire. I told him I was part Aborigine, you know. And then I think Gary appeared shortly after in 72, came down from Sydney. Bruce brought him down to give a few talks and so on. And I think it was from that moment on, I think we saw each other every day.
Is this some type of love affair or something?
I think it was a sort of love affair.
There was a lot of stuff politically happening around out of Monash at the time, which was the main base from where we were operating. And, I mean, we shared a house in them days. There was a big mob of mad, radical students and me and Bruce McGuinness.
And that's right. I think Gary's made a film about a house he shared with other people.
That was much later,
but it was nothing like the house we shared, which came a few years earlier. That would have been a very good film. We can still do it, Gary.
Indeed, we could.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, then we saw Gary and it became a political and a close friendship, the whole crowd of us was, yep.
You weren't a Maoist, were you?
I think we were.
You were.
Well, look, I was going to make a Gary. You know a bit about Asia, don't you?
Indeed, I do.
You've made that documentary film and so on. I just want to know if are they listening?
Oh, inevitably, well, invariably, and inevitably.
Well, thank goodness it would have been an insult if they didn't bother listening to us anymore. Yes. What were you saying, Jay?
Yes.
Now tell us, Angelo, were you born in Australia or where were you born?
I was born in under a wandering star. No, I was born. I was born in a little town called Rocca d'Arcie, in the middle of Dolomites in northern Italy. You're both art lovers. Bruegel's painting, "The Hunter's Return," mm-hmm. Joe.
Yep.
You know the snow fields and the skating, kids skating on the lake, mm. the chapel, the church with the steeple, and the hunters and the sleds and so on. That's it. Yeah. That's the village of 3,000 people. I still dream about it every day, actually.
Yeah. There's a long history of UMOB coming across. Yeah. I mean, political refugees from the 20s, from fascism.
Well, that's right.
Like Francesco Fantini was murdered at Camp Loveday in 42.
Yes.
A lot of Venetians came across.
Yes. I've always wanted to find out the connection with Fantini because my next-door neighbour, my parents' next-door neighbour in Rocca and the ones who have married my father's sister are Fantini, so there must be a connection.
There must be a connection there.
Yes, and yes, there is. In fact, the reason we're here is because my great uncle came before the First World War, and came over and worked in Port Pirie for a while. Then he went back and fought the First World War for Italy, and then returned after the First World War, went back to Port Pirie or whatever, and then found out that they were building a road somewhere here, and it was the Great Ocean Road. And a lot of Italians apparently were working on the Great Ocean Road, not just the diggers. And he worked along on the Great Ocean Road just after the First World War. And then he was seconded to build the road between Melbourne and the Latrobe Valley where there was the open cut electricity. And that's where they all settled. He then, going up there, found out that all these farms were being bought up and so on, and they were dairy farmers from the Dolomite area in Italy. And so he bought a land around Latrobe Valley. And I've got a tribe up there that go back to before the First World War and afterwards.
Yeah, yep. There's an extraordinary amount of Italian immigration before even my grandfather migrated to Ingham.
Okay.
In between the wars, and he went back to Italy, but left his 16-year-old son there. And then the war broke out and he was stuck there, and then he got interned. So there's a huge amount of political refugees came out of Italy in the 20s.
Yes.
And they were very active in Australia.
Yes.
And again, they would have, you know, they were followed by the secret police in those days and harassed. So fascinating.
I have to make a confession, though.
What?
The uncle that came
back. He was a fascist, obviously.
He was.
Yeah, we know that. We know that. That's why he came back.
That's why.
He was welcome.
No. He went. He was a patriot fascist. He became a fascist because, in fact, he went after coming here in 1913 or 12, went back to fight for Italy.
That's right.
And then came back in 1918. Now, I don't know why he was.
He
so
would have been an Alpini.
I think he
would. He would have been an Alpini, yeah.
But when he came over here.
Crack Italian troops.
The only way of, and I remember having arguments with very elderly back then, because in the 60s and the 70s I would talk to him about it. And he describes a time in between the wars where there's a fair bit of discrimination, and he heard all this news about Mussolini building up the country and so on, and also kept saying that Mussolini did a lot for the farmers, and because he was a farmer, you know, they turned to him.
Yeah,
but no, he wasn't.
He was
unfortunately, I have to admit
that. Well, I've got a confession too.
Yeah,
we may as well.
Joe.
My actual father fought in the Second World War on the other side.
Which
but
side?
The other side.
From the Australian American.
Yes, yes.
Well, my father did too.
That's right. Yeah.
He had to, but he didn't.
Well,
he had to.
They were conscripted.
No,
that's exactly
He spent several years in Albania.
Yeah.
He came back telling stories, and they're pretty horrendous stories.
Horrendous, that's right. They were very reluctant soldiers, those men.
In fact, the only reason he lived was in 1943, he asked to be excused from Albania to go back to Italy to marry my mother. And they allowed him to go back, and he came back and married, and he had a few months off. He was supposed to go back to his regiment or whatever, and he faked having malaria, and then there was the armistice and he had to head for the hills. So if he didn't come back, all his regiment that surrendered during the armistice were all grabbed by the Germans and sent to the Russian front. I don't think one returned.
No, that'd be right.
Mm. And so when did your dad come out of here then?
My dad came out in 1950, although, as I said, my great uncle came out before. He came out in 1950 with a lot of other of his relatives, post-war, no work, and he came out on his own. And we followed 7 years after. He, in fact, came out 6 months after I was born. I hope that's coincidental. But and I didn't see him for 7 years. I didn't know who he was until 7 years.
Yeah, that was normal.
57. That was normal.
Normal.
Sounds unreal now, but...
well, many of the refugees who come now, same story.
Exactly.
Exactly
the
same
story. We go, wow, how could you do that and not see your parents? And then I think back of my own and, yeah.
So tell us a bit about life in Italy before you come out here, before you were seven.
It was, I told you, it's Bruegel's painting. Gary, have you been to...
Yes, but what did you remember?
Gary, you
tell me about you there.
You haven't been to Rocca, have you?
No.
I've been to Nambucca more times than you have. Your
indeed,
place.
That's right. This is true, folks.
Well, you'll have to repay the compliment.
Well, Gary, I did try to once, as I recall. I got close.
You did, 1879 it was.
And then somehow or other I ended up in...
Germany.
In Salzburg somewhere. Mm. And you and McGuinness went swanning off down to the north of Italy.
That's right. And
McGuinness
Paris.
Got there and I never.
That's right. He saw it.
I never
he
made
even
it.
Went up above the first floor. And, yep, so about the place, well... Look, for 7 years, I did 1 year of schooling. It was it was a happy time. Although you say, well, without your dad and that, it was a village of 3,000, and next to it was the comune. So this was a frazione, which is a small village. The comune is the municipal town, and that was about 5,000 or 6,000. And then beyond that, another 15 kilometres is the city, the provincial city, like Feltre, and that had a university and so on. My grandparents were alive, my uncles were there. I had a lot of interaction with all family. It was very much a community, so it was pretty blissful. My memories of it.
Well, that's the difference, isn't it? It takes a village to raise a child, and that's what it was like, and we've forgotten. Yeah. We've forgotten that now, we're all atomised.
I was happy to leave, though. I mean, my sisters, who were 9 and 13, were crying, but I think it was at that age that I really didn't understand it. I didn't care about my friends. I said, oh, we're going to go on a boat and see the equator, see whales, and they were wailing while they were crying. And here I was as happy as anything, and also to see my father, who I was told was going to have bags of money, and so I imagined potato sacks of all this money like coming out. yes. Well, anyway, look, it was quite pleasant.
One of the people I've met through you over the years was Stefano.
Yes.
And Sergio.
Yes.
This is Stefano Di Pieri. Mm-hmm. Did they live in the same village or what?
No.
What was the connection with them?
The connection with them is I've met them over here, but the connection with them, I didn't know them there. The connection with them is that they come from a place called Dossong, which is just outside of Treviso. We're all in the province of Veneto. Joe's in in Sicily.
Sicily, provincia Catania.
Catania. Mm. So our province is Veneto, and there are regions. Not regions, I don't know. Treviso and Vicenza and so on. They come from an area, it's all within the province of Venice, and it's just outside of Treviso. And my mother, from the age of about six, left the town where I was born and where my father was from, in the mountains, only an hour away, to work for her uncles, who had bought some properties in this town of Dossong, which is where Sergio and Stefano come from. In fact, right next door to them, which is something we found out many years after, when we met here in the 70s, when I met Stefano when he was working for Filef and other things.
So what's the claim to fame for you two old radicals at Monash? What did you do apart from live in some shared house?
We sat on beanbags, remember?
Tell us about those days, you two.
Those days, Gary,
were the good old days.
They were the days where it was a real community. They were the days that every time you woke up in the morning, you were sure of meeting several close friends and girlfriends and so on, and in between study, and that you're going to have a lot of talk and some action. And things were happening every day. I cannot remember seasons, and I can't remember night and day virtually. I just remember sort of people. It was pretty full on, and it went for a number of years for me.
And when I read my ASIO file from that era, I realised, which I didn't realise till I read my ASIO file. I realised that
Angelo was the spy.
No.
Sorry.
People in our crew were. But one of the interesting things about reading the ASIO files is that I never realised just how much political work that we did. We were actually very busy little beavers,
yes,
around the traps. And we went to hundreds of meetings. And, you know, it was a really exciting time to be alive politically, to be young and to be politically active. You know, there was constantly sort of demos and, you know, just a real... we believed at the time we could change the world. In fact, I would argue that we did.
Yeah, and I remember Gary and Bruce, and I think I said that at one of our parties, in a little speech I gave or something, and it really came to me that when Gary got his doctorate in history, Bruce and him were really just gatherers of history, because they would be there with photos and articles in their rooms and so on, folders, and putting them together and taking photos. And so they were actually, I said to Gary, he commenced his book, your book, back then. And but in fact, not just writing about it, but they were creating history then. But my involvement, to lump it into the student politics, but there's also, I think, when I met Bruce, Gary was part of it, of course, but I think it was more with Bruce. Bruce, when we met him, and not just me and a few of us, we got friendly in the student politics. But what he did was quite amazing. Here we are, some sort of middle class or Italian migrants, others, you know, Jewish or whatever. There are a whole crowd of us. He took us into his political field, but it took us into the Aboriginal community. Here we are, young people, and we went in to their houses. We met them all from, first of all, the Advancement League, but not just the organisations, to go to their houses. They welcomed us in there. We went to the cabarets every Saturdays and so on. It was incredible. It was like a family. I had never experienced anything like it. And I think we became a sort of a unit of not just political friends and just young people, but also with a wider community, I think.
It's quite an extraordinary experience, because I had exactly the same experience in Brisbane. I knew no Aboriginal people until I went to university, and then there were a number of radicals on campus who actually weren't enrolled.
Yeah.
But campus was, everybody used to come to campus.
Yeah, I wasn't enrolled at Monash.
No, no, that's right.
No, you know.
Go on.
No, I'm just saying the same thing happened, you know. You'd meet these people, you'd see they were genuine, they'd take you to their home, they'd introduce you to their family, they showed you the conditions they lived under, they talked about the act, what it meant, and it was a radicalising experience. It's quite extraordinary that we had the same experience.
Oh, look,
you know, 2,000 kilometres apart.
Look, I could mention all the families there, the Thorpes and Hoffmans and all of it right through, how the women and the guys that, you know, they're quite a few years older than us, that we would just sit in their rooms, meet their kids, go away on holidays with them. I think in the first few years we went away on holidays up to Narooma and so on with the whole crowd. It was quite amazing. I had never experienced that. That couple, that friendship and that community feel, coupled with what we were doing politically, and some of it, as Gary's thing, was pretty radical stuff, gave us a sense of real security and sort of, sure of ourselves a bit, because we had this whole grown-up and whole community around us, giving us strength. It was amazing.
And for me and McGuinness too, it was a pretty interesting experience for us, because it broadened our horizons. We learned about all sorts of situations that we hadn't heard about before. We learned about, you know, all sort of Italian history stuff from Angelo. We had the biggest lesson on Macedonia from Jimmy Rendeski.
You'll have him by hearing.
And, you know, one of the other people on the fringes of our crew is one of our former guests, Joe, and that was Red Bingham. Was very much sort of one of the singers.
Yes, he was a poet. He was the poet. He would read your palm and sing songs and ditties and so on. He read his I think he's a full time court jester and political activist. We love Red.
More of a political activist than you think. I mean, you may always underestimate the influence that anarchists have.
Yes, after saying that about ASIO, can I make a statement? I was going to.
You weren't responsible.
And after Obama, hearing Obama, I'd like to say, I'd like to make one thing perfectly clear. I am not and have never been a member of a Communist Party or subversive organization. But I have been a fellow traveller. Now that I've got that out.
We used to make fun back in the early 70s of Tricky Dick.
That's right.
Nowadays we make fun of the coconut president of America.
That's right. Anyway. I thought I'd throw in that for you, for your benefit, Gary.
So,
and for those listening, yes, I mean, have you had a lawyer on here before?
No.
Well,
no.
You know what I asked? Because I was wondering whether they would have been struck off the roll.
No. No.
I thought you were going to offer to do a free legal advice segment like on the John Fain show.
No, no. Well, we can do that. Okay, you can have people ring.
No.
This is Radical Australia. No.
Anyway, I'm at the end of my political career, so I don't care what happens.
Gary, why have you invited a lawyer into the studio?
Because before he was a lawyer.
You didn't tell me he was a lawyer.
Before he was a lawyer. Before he had a highly successful practice in Sydney Road, Brunswick, which we'll give an ad for later, he was very much part of the process for change back
in the
day.
But you know
why
I got into law?
Well, because Gary was arrested, I assume, and he needed it.
That's right.
Tell us, Angelo, I'll
tell you the story.
You went to Monash.
I went to Monash, and I was having, as I said, we're having so much fun there with the students, with the community and so on, and I was in dip head. And I was to start teaching in some country school. And over the Christmas break, Gary was living in the house of a film director. What was he?
Tim Burstall
in Nicholson Street. And I remember it quite clearly. We went visiting Gary there and one afternoon. And Jim, you can ask him this next week when he comes or whenever he comes, came along. We're having a yarn there. And Jim came along and said, and I was to start teaching just 2-3 months after that, because it was the Christmas break. I'd finished my politics and economics and dip ed. And Jim said, you can go and enrol in law. And I said, what? And there was also Pat Del Mastro there, who's...
So what year was this?
1970.
This is in the days of free.
Free. Education, FRW, yeah.
And Pat Del Mastro was also to... he's a comrade who's long past us... So they said, we'll all go and apply because none of us wanted to go and work. So they didn't get in because they'd failed or something and I got in. But also, I must admit, I was involved with the Aboriginal Legal Service
in the early days.
In the early days, along with Gareth Evans, one of your fans, Louis Waller. Gareth Evans was actually the treasurer. Lenny Hartnett.
Tell us a little bit about the early days of the Aboriginal Legal Service. This is a unique perspective.
Well, I only attended a few of the meetings, but it was just being formed at that time. And my memory of it was that there was a big Aboriginal input into it, and a lot of it came out of people from Monash, even like Louis Waller, who was the Dean of the Faculty, I think was one of the initiators. Gareth Evans was the treasurer. There was Mick Dodson involved. There was Lenny. There was a whole lot of people. And this would have been in about 1970, Gary,
'72. Yep.
So I had some sort of experience with people working in Aboriginal.
And so you just mentioned that.
But I never worked for them.
Of the people that was
Gary wouldn't let me.
One of the people
Hang on, Gary. What do you mean Gary wouldn't let you work for them? What's going on here? Come on, spill the beans.
I think it was. I was so close to Gary and Bruce, who were in the health service, the co-op, and so on, that I felt that if I began working as a professional, in one of the organisations. Like, I think we decided it was best left for those people who wanted to make a career out of it.
The do-gooders, you know, the people who work for the Aboriginal organisations them days, we didn't like them. We despised them.
For example,
Gareth Evans. You know, it was Gareth Evans-type people, the do-gooders, who were so keen. And Angelo was out of a different mould to them sort of people, and we didn't want him to taint himself.
Didn't want to lose friendships.
And we preferred to have him as a friend rather than, you know, as someone who we despise.
I'm glad we've cleared that up. I was a bit worried there, Angelo.
You also mentioned in that little burst that I'd forgotten the Dodson brothers were at Monash in them days. Tell us about that. They were...
Well, Mick, I met Mick before I met you. Yeah. I met Mick at Mannix College, and he had come from, and he wasn't, Mick, if he's listening, he should be listening. He certainly is listening, isn't he?
Well, you're going to slander him. That's why you want him to listen.
No.
Oh, you're a lawyer. You know the defamation laws.
No, I better watch it. No, Mick, I knew him and when we were young, we really went through and with his family and so on and his children and everything. Mick met, would have been in 1970 at Mannix College, and he'd started law then, come from a country school, wasn't involved in politics at all, I must admit. It took a while for Mick. When I'm saying politics, he was in the Aboriginal field that I didn't know about, but the student politics, he was not involved in that until, I think, towards the end of his legal studies. But I do remember one thing with Mick. One of the meetings, and this gives you an idea of what Fitzroy was like then, and Gertrude Street. We had a meeting with in the setting up, or one of the meetings to set up the legal service. It was at the
builders,
just down from the builders, near the dental service, near opposite the Australia China Bookshop in Gertrude Street. Remember that little thing, and there was Gareth Evans, Louis Waller, myself, Lenny, Mick, a few other people, a huge big Aboriginal community. And Lenny, Mick and I went for a drink to the Builders Arms, or for a walk. And as we were walking up, a police car came down Gertrude Street, slowed down, took a good look at us. I mean, we stopped the car. Three officers came out, or two or three, didn't look at me and Lenny, and grabbed Mick and pushed him up against the wall and said, "Who are you and whatever?" And he was very calm. And Lenny, as you know, Lenny Wood.
We're talking Lenny Hart.
Yes, he said, he said, "Officers, do you want to come down here? We have the Dean of the Faculty of Law, we have the President of the ALP or whatever he was, and do you know what?" And they sort of backed off. But they took his name and said, I remember they said, "We haven't seen your face around here before." Mick was calm as anything. I mean, he must have been used to this. And off they took his name and so on. They didn't even look at us, didn't even recognise us, and then drove off. And then we went back to... calmly, and we were a bit upset, but Mick was very calm, and we went back to the meeting with his high-powered people and so on, and this was the experience. Talking about why there was a necessity to have a legal service around, we experienced it just 1 minute before.
For the young people out there, I think I should point out that the period Angelo's talking about is the days when there was a fairly sizable Aboriginal community here in Fitzroy. Mm. And Gertrude Street was, in fact, the Aboriginal street. And so that the police harassment of Aboriginal people around here that was taking place was taking place in what today is a very trendy street, Gertrude Street, and along Smith Street. Mm. And people should think to themselves, well, you know, in them days there was an Aboriginal community upwards around 8,000 people strong. And they're not there anymore, you know. And people should think about that, because that means that in our lifetimes, the people who are sitting here anyway, in our lifetimes there's been a modern-day dispersal of an Aboriginal community. And that Aboriginal community that was dispersed from Fitzroy were, in fact, in the beginning, refugees from other Aboriginal communities around the state, you know. So there's been a constant sort of moving on of the Aboriginal community that continues to, you know, the very time that we speak now.
Yes, and look, it was a huge Koori population here, and I think a Yugoslav too.
Yeah, Yugoslav. Croats mainly.
Yeah, Croats. And yes, that's exactly right, Gary. But what stuck out for me was, and I think there must have been, for the police to patrol, they must have been looking at sort of regular faces.
Yeah.
Mick, I think, might have been his... I'm not going to say that. I could be wrong. One of his first times. One of his first times in Gertrude Street, I think Mick came from the country. He lived in Mannix and was out there. I think he was a bit isolated in the first few years.
Lived in the safety of Mannix, and suddenly he's in Fitzroy.
No criticism to Mick.
And he's a new face.
He's a new face
to the coppers. He's a new face.
And I think that might have been one of the few times that he came into the community, the Aboriginal community. I'm pretty sure he would agree with me. And so they must have actually. Yeah, talk about profiling profiles, of spotting someone. There's a new face. Find out who he is. Mm. And he was pushed up. Yeah, anyway.
All right, you graduate, okay? You finally graduate. How many years did it take you?
No, it only took me three. You mean all three degrees? Or
No. Just the regional law degree.
I mean, Gary.
Gary and I could tell you about our degrees, but we won't. We won't. We won't embarrass you. Mm. So, you're a law degree. What year did you get there?
77.
Now, I'm going to ask you a very important question that every Italian boy needs to answer.
Yes.
And you'll know this because of the cultural background.
Yes.
Here you are, struggling parents, come to Australia, work their butt off.
Yes.
You're enjoying yourself at university.
Yes.
You finally bloody graduate.
Yeah.
Did you go to the graduation ceremony and did your parents turn up?
No.
No?
I've had three graduations and three times were refused to. I did not go. I don't think Gary went. Hold on. He may have gone to the last one. No, I didn't. And I actually, my parents didn't even come to when I was admitted.
Mm.
We were hard nuts.
Hard nuts.
We laughed. We scoffed at ceremony. We thought they were just for the sort of mediocre, you know.
Right.
Who wants to go over there and put a funny gown on? Sorry, Gary. Now I know you've done it now. I would do it now too. It looks good. It looks good on you. So
it was easy for you. It's easy for you to say that because you graduated when you were young. I graduated when I was an old man on the verge of sort of being pensioned off.
Mm.
And so,
but
anyway,
no,
and the vice chancellor came.
What did your parents think about that?
They
would have been devastated.
Look,
I mean, are they still alive?
No, they're not.
Oh, thank God for that.
No, I think my parents would have. I think I already stated my ideas to them about the humbug of ceremony and all that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know. We grew up Catholics and went to church and all that sort of stuff. When we rebelled against that, I thought I'd better make a, you know.
Have you got kids now?
Yes, two kids. One, as I said, my son, Vittorio, is a great fan of yours.
Well, he's a very intelligent man. Now, have they graduated?
Who?
Your children. Are they old enough to go to uni?
No, one's Vittorio has graduated.
Yeah,
that's right. He's graduated at Monash, but he's now doing another degree.
Did you go to his graduation?
No.
No. What's going on here?
I didn't. In fact, I don't think I even thought of it.
I can't believe this.
No.
Gary, you ask him a question. I'm shocked.
No. Right. Now, I'll tell you what. There's something in Stefano. The Venetian, we're sort of a... We don't stand much on ceremony.
Yeah, humbug. You've had enough humbug.
We're mountain people. We just go around doing the sort of normal things.
Yeah.
Who wants to do that? Yeah, okay. Leave that to the kings and queens and all this sort of stuff. Yeah.
Oh, I'm shocked here, Gary.
Yeah, okay. Now, my son, I didn't go to his graduation. That's right.
Well, I mean, would Vittorio have gone to his graduation?
No.
Vittorio's a very admirable young man, I can tell you.
No, I don't think he did. No, of course he didn't.
He's maintaining a family tradition here.
He's maintaining
a new sort of family
tradition. A refusenik. The refusenik's from Park Street. Oh, geez. Daniela said, don't mention the street.
No, just
you know
in
that
case.
Lot that listen? And she said, that's my daughter, and don't mention my ideas, you know, I've heard what they do.
Don't mention her name.
God! We're gone. Sorry.
There you go. Yeah, well, look, you're on Facebook?
No.
Oh, are your kids on Facebook?
Yes.
Oh, no. Well, they know everything about them then. Well, they know everything about them.
I don't know how to do it. I know Gary's very good because Gary's been into computers for a long time. He must have played with
Meccano. Indeed, I have.
Yeah, Meccano sets and stuff.
I got into computers very early in the piece, before computers were computers, in fact.
Yes. Yes.
But it's just, I was just trying to prove something to myself at that point, trying to prove my brain still worked.
Yes.
But I've since got a doctorate, so now that I know my brain works.
Yeah, well, you're not a Johnny Come Lately, though. You were there before there, too.
Indeed.
Yeah, you've just got the recognition later.
It was actually, did you ever meet John Newfong?
Yes, John Newfong, absolutely.
He's the man who taught me about communications technology. Talk about John.
Well, John, I remember, John, in a pinstripe suit.
Yep.
And
something like the one you're wearing.
Well,
today.
Exactly. And we were in awe. That's probably why. We were in awe of John. And now, what happened to him?
He died sadly.
Yes.
But he was the great communications genius of the Aboriginal political movement in the 60s and 70s, and he played a key role in the 1967 referendum. But he also was the media genius at the Aboriginal Embassy. In fact, he was Australia's first professional Aboriginal journalist working in the mainstream. He wrote for The Bulletin. He actually wrote for Bloody Australian when Murdoch first set it up in the 60s, when the Australian was, in fact, left-wing in the 60s. And worked...
It was left-wing?
Yes.
Absolutely,
yes.
In fact, can I tell you...
They supported the Aboriginal embassy.
In my school... St. Paul's College, Traralgon, the brothers or someone told us, we didn't read the newspapers, but to be careful of the Australian because he'd had a little red Australia up in the corner, which meant that they planned to turn Australia into a communist state. How's that, Murdoch?
Yeah, well, he's changed.
And is the red... thing still there?
Don't
Red
know.
Australia?
I think it is.
I think that could be. It could be one of those.
Rupert's overlooked that.
He was a socialist in England.
Yeah. But, did you know, talking about newspaper headmasters, that The Age, when it was formed in 1856, I think, or 1854, had a tumbrel, which is the executioner's cart, which they used to take royalty to the guillotine as its masthead.
Oh, true.
That's how radical it was in those days.
Wow. Then to a red Australian. Okay.
Yeah.
We should expose them.
Exactly. Both of them.
They could be a danger to our society.
Now, I'm going to ask you another personal question.
Yeah, okay.
Now, look, to me, a successful lawyer. Now, you classify yourself as a lawyer?
Yes, but not successful.
Yeah. Well, to me, a successful lawyer is a person who has... tailor-made suit. Now, I've noticed your suit isn't tailor-made.
What's
happened?
No, it's not tailor-made. What's the
you'd
street
be too
in
embarrassed,
Richmond?
Wouldn't you?
What's the street in Richmond?
Victoria Street.
Yes. Just opposite a really favourite restaurant of mine, Ming Tang 2 or whatever, and we often go to it, there's two suits for the price of one and off the rack.
Yeah, I've been there.
Exactly.
I go there for my funeral suits.
Well,
It's
and Liz and I...
Fletcher Jones or something.
No, it wasn't David, Fletcher Jones.
David,
it's in the corner.
Yeah, I know the
one.
Yeah,
Express.
I know the one.
Anyway, I'm giving plugs here for everybody. And I said, two suits for the price of one and two pants and something and off the rack. And I walked in there and a guy who looked like John Newfong, actually, sort of tall and with a, came up to me and said, no problem with you, and measured me out, and here it is.
Right.
Now, Joe, you're very well dressed today, and I can see. How can you tell that this is not Taylor?
I can tell.
He's Italian.
He's Italian.
Doesn't matter his politics.
Yeah, exactly.
Italian. You know the first thing, the terrible thing about Italians, doesn't matter whether they're radical or whatever
that's
it is.
That's right.
The first thing they do to you when you walk in, they give you the once-over.
Exactly.
They say the shoes, and they look up and they go,
Il passeggero, that's the thing. You know what?
Miseria.
Miseria. Pedicioso.
Oh, God, okay. Well, it's good that we haven't lost those traits, no matter what.
No, I could tell it wasn't tailor-made.
Well,
I thought you mustn't have much of a practice.
Well, I told you, unfortunately, Unfortunately, I haven't listened to your program because I do the afternoon shift. My partner does the morning shift. But my son, Vittorio, listens to it. And you know what he calls the show?
What?
The Lefties Nostalgia Hour.
Ah, isn't that nice?
They can be cruel.
That's a good subtitle. It's nice. That's nice.
The LNH.
Yeah, yeah, that's very nice.
It is
very
nice. Yeah.
At least it's still around. There is a bit of nostalgia. It's a little bit like Radical Australia, you know.
But he listens to it all the time.
Good on you, Vittorio.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, things change. And, so what do you specialise in your practice? Or do you do anything?
Oh, do we?
Anything for a buck?
Anything for a buck. No, mate, look, it's personal injuries.
Personal injuries.
Yeah, only for the workers.
Right.
Oh, that's yep. Yeah,
good. And then what?
And Angelo is, I should say, something of a famous art connoisseur of Brunswick.
Art connoisseur. Okay.
Connoisseur. Yeah. Really?
Well, I tell you who got me into it, but unfortunately I didn't. Two people, but unfortunately I didn't listen to them too much. Lynn Onus, of course.
Yes.
And Lynn was part of our crowd, and he too was one who was around at Monash but wasn't a student. But he formed part of that group from about 1972. He was up in the hills and painting and so on. But then he enrolled and did an anthropology degree shortly after Bruce, or just the same time. And
remember he did sound on Bruce McGuinness's films.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We saw each other, I think, yeah, every day. I think I saw Lynn every day. He would come down, we would go up to Upway, and he would come down to Clayton. And anyway, we attended his first exhibition. My sister,
very first, yes.
Very first. My sister, who had money then, we were students, bought one of his paintings, and she's got it in Italy. She now lives in Italy. And Joe and Tiriki know this because he kept a diary. He did his first portrait of anybody because he was basically
landscape,
yeah. Trees, ferns, landscape, was me. But then he sold it to someone. I could never trace it down. A German couple. Maybe we can call out to Germany now for that painting. So there was Lynn who got me interested, but of course we were young and so on. And then there was a friend of Gary's, Bernard
Lulutti.
Who was another German who came here and did so much for publicising the Aboriginal art.
Bernard Lutti was responsible for the most successful Aboriginal art exhibition to ever leave Australia's shores, the Arajara exhibition that I opened the Copenhagen leg of that. But it was held in Paris, Dusseldorf, Gorbenhaven, and London. And it's, to this day, in terms of feet through the door, it's the most successful Australian art exhibition in history. And it's also the first time that so-called traditional Aboriginal art was exhibited alongside of so-called contemporary Aboriginal art and urban, so-called urban Aboriginal art. So it's a very significant sort of thing. And Mad Bernard is an old mate of me and Angelo's as well.
He keeps fighting. The initial one was, I remember, was trying to bring the exhibition in Europe and fighting against those who saw Aboriginal art as purely...
Ethnographic,
you know. And he was trying to explain this is more than that, it's contemporary art. It's gone beyond that. And finally they came to see that. And we've been in contact with him recently too. Mm. I think he's now hosting some of your friends over to a art exhibition.
Yeah, people want me to go to Europe all the time now.
I know, Gary.
And I'm too old to get on.
You know why
plane.
Gary doesn't go to overseas? You know what his favourite program is? Air crash investigations.
It's true.
What can you do with the man? What can you do with the man? I mean, you know, you'll have to take him back to Brugal country, you know. So this art connoisseur, what do you mean?
He's
got the best art collection in Brunswick.
Not true.
In Brunswick. Well, that wouldn't be very hard.
I shouldn't be saying this. Every burglar in town's listening.
Well, that wouldn't be hard. Brunswick, no.
It's not. It's a few of our friends and stuff.
It's pretty sensational. It's got, Richard Bell beside Andy Warhol and a whole swag of others.
Yes. Well, that's well, right.
Are you on the donation list for the Australian, the Victoria National Gallery, or what they call themselves, National Gallery?
I put my name down so they can donate things to me. Yes.
Yeah, that's good. That's good.
Definitely not the other
because
way.
Because I've noticed when I walk in, there's all these, you know, well-known lawyers, you know, up on the wall. Are you one of them now?
No. Gary's making it sound like I am not Gary.
Let's slightly change the subject by saying, I didn't make it to that exhibition last week at the Brunswick Town Hall. Tell us about that.
It was very
because
good.
There's a picture of me in that.
There is. That? And Gary always will ring you up when there's a picture of him.
That's right.
And he made everybody turn up, and he was fantastic.
But is it a famous gallery? Well, it is named after a famous
Noel
anarchist.
Coonahan Gallery in Brunswick. And I've got a whole set of Noel Coonahan. And I met his son.
Communist.
Yes.
Communist. Noel Lefty. Yes.
Noel Coonahan is one of our great stories.
One of the great social realists.
That's right. Mm. There's a story about him how during the campaign in the 30s or whatever of free speech. He locked himself in a cage
in Brunswick near Albion Street, and it took the police about 2 hours to extricate him from it. And on the same protest, one of the protesters was shot in the leg.
That's right.
In 1933. Yeah.
That's right. They were.
And so there's a gallery named after him now in the Brunswick Town Hall.
The Noel Coonahan Gallery, and they have a lot of his works there. And it was both his works and contemporary works, all with a political bent. And you're in, Gary, and it's a good one by Texter Queen, is it?
Texter Queen. It's the
Texter Queen.
Yes.
It's in fact, I'll just chuck in a plug here. It's a portrait of me that she, what's it called? The creature from the Black Platoon.
The Black Platoon.
And it's in this exhibition on loan from the National Portrait Gallery, folks. Wanted to chuck that in.
It's like a poster.
It's one of several portraits in the National Portrait Gallery of me, in fact.
It's like a poster of a movie. And it's got Gary as a sort of a monster from the
Black. A monster, yeah.
Well, like it's part of it or something. And
it's part of a series.
To our society with
a gun. It's part of a series that included a poster of Robbie Thorpe as the, I'm trying to remember what his thing was, but the poster of Robbie has Robbie there with on his shoulder in the form of a grenade launcher,
sure.
Didgeridoo as a grenade launcher. It's brilliant.
I think you've got something. Yeah, you know, it's very good. And who else was there? There was some artwork, but an old friend I hadn't seen for some time, one of friends of Pat Del Mastro, Peter Lisiotis. I'll just give him a plug. One of his works is there. And the son of Noel Coonahan, who I met, who is giving talks on. No, it was very good. Yes, thank you, Gary, for letting us know. But, of course, Gary didn't turn up because
he
had the same reason I wasn't here last week.
Yeah, look, he was sick.
Yes, well, how I was in hospital, if you must know. You lot.
Yes,
I may not have been sick, but I was in hospital.
We care.
It was. I told him he had an appointment with Bruce McGuinness, our friend, because Bruce, on the day that Gary had his second scare, was at the 10th anniversary to the day of Bruce's death.
And I was in the hospital where Bruce died.
Yes, and Gary and I spent about 1 or 2 weeks with Bruce in that spot, if you remember, 10 years ago. Mm. And so anyway, but you're on deck now, I can
see. We're both on deck now.
That's
good. We're all on deck.
We're all on deck.
Mercifully.
Mercifully.
And talking about, before I forget, did I mention about Liz before? To you outside, but not on radio, did I?
What?
No. That Pat Del Mastro, who's a friend of the one I mentioned, my partner Liz told me that in 1975 she had a program here in 3CR, a teacher's program called... 1975. Called... Excuse This Interruption.
Yeah.
It was a teacher's program. And... And
was that the name of the show?
Excuse me for this
75.
Interruption.
She may have done it in Melbourne. The studios were in Melbourne.
No, down here.
At 20 Quamrell Street.
Yep. So, and so she interviewed our friend Pat Del Mastro, and she's still got the tape of him talking about his migrant days. And also she interviewed Bill Morrow and lots of other people. So it's a nice circle that we've almost 40 years ago.
It is almost 40 years ago. Mm. Almost 40 years ago. Because 3CR is gearing up for its 40th anniversary celebration.
That's right.
So hopefully the staff at the front have got something interesting lined up.
I'm sure they
Birthday
will.
Birthday cake?
Well, hopefully more than a birthday cake. Maybe that bazooka that they were talking about now that we're in the Murdoch's Minions era.
Yes, any post-electoral stress?
Oh, on the contrary, I love it when the Conservatives are in power.
Yeah, yeah.
Sharpens the focus, doesn't it? The contradictions.
And my cousin's his number one Aboriginal advisor, the white sheep of the family, Warren Mundy.
Well,
we've all got white sheep.
We'll have to invite him down here, Gary. Invite him to this show.
Indeed. Now, interesting, Angelo, you said your sister had gone back to Italy. That's, I mean, you did mention that she was very upset when she left when she was a young girl. So when did she go back and how was she finding it?
Two sisters. I had both older than me, and one sister, Josephine, returned because she met an Italian chap here in the 60s, and he'd been here only 7 years, and they married in 68 and said, look, we better go over. And apart from visits here, they haven't returned. She's got three lovely children, and my niece and nephews. And my other sister went over, Mickey, who used to cut Gary's hair.
He used to cut my hair.
Yeah, she was, so we were all together when in those times. That's right, and I still got hair. And she went over for a holiday in 1974 and didn't come back. Met someone, met Carlo, and she's remained there. So both my sisters are there. Then my parents have died. In fact, they returned just before they died to the Bruegel village. They left me a house there. That's why I invited Gary over.
Yeah, you haven't sold the house yet, have you?
No. We're renovating.
Renovating. Sounds good.
We planned that we might be going over to reignite those dreams of Bruegel sleds.
But it's fascinating how deep the association is, isn't it? The migration, people think the migration story is always a one-way story.
No.
But in many cases, people return and children return and they can never... You never feel quite at home in an alien society.
No.
You may speak the language, you may understand the culture, but there is that feeling that you want to go back.
Absolutely.
You think you'd retire in Italy?
Look, retire, certainly have more visits there. And just to bring you back to Gary on this, Gary had been telling me and Bruce, and I think one of the difficult things of Gary or Bruce's passing is that he could never convince Bruce to go to his country. Gary came to Bruce's country down here and saw it like you know, but he could never convince Bruce to go up to Nambucca. Finally, I went up there for the first time, and you know where Gary took me?
Where?
To the cemetery.
Yeah. Well, it's the best. You'll meet more Curie people at a cemetery than anywhere else.
He showed me all his relatives, and I'll tell you what, it's got the best view of Nambucca.
it's the best place cemetery around, right? Beautiful view of the sea.
You reserved yourself a spot.
Well, he has.
Yes or no?
Let's not talk about that.
The important part of Angelo's story is that this man here, this Italian from north of Italy, has been back to my hometown at least a dozen times more than me in the last 10 or 15 years.
Yeah, his folks always say, how's Gary? I say,
that's right. He's seen my parents more than I've seen my parents in the last 15 years.
Yes, that's right.
What's going on here, Gary? Come on. Mm-hmm. Spill the beans. Why don't you go back?
Travel. In my talks, I gave a talk out at Darwin City Council today. I told them, I tell in all my talks, I come from redneck heaven. And and that's why I live in Melbourne. That's why I stick to Melbourne. And I say to my students, you go beyond the tram tracks of Melbourne and you're in the land of dangerous, venomous Australian creatures. And I don't mean red-bellied snakes or red-backed spiders. I mean rednecks. Mm. And so I have an aversion. But Angelo can go and... Angelo's... As you've heard today, folks,
he's the immigrant success story.
Sort of character,
he
makes friends anywhere.
I mean, he's the immigrant success story. Comes here as a poor boy, goes through school, son of a peasant, becomes a successful lawyer, art connoisseur,
Sydney Road lawyer.
Yes. You got the wrong picture of me. The art is interesting, but
it's impressive to me.
A successful lawyer is I'd hardly put myself in the idea of the successful.
Look, we don't have self-effacing guests. We don't have self-effacing guests. You've got to promote yourself as a radical. It's that simple.
You know? Now, back at my village also, when you mentioned about going back and getting back there, they've got a little cemetery. That's where my parents are actually buried, and it has the best view. It's overlooking. I'm telling you, the village is it's stunning. Why is it that they always reserve the best views for the deceased? I think,
because if you don't give them a good resting place, they get angry. Mm. It's that simple, you know?
Look, it's an interesting little village. We're sort of running out of time, but it has, talking about politics, it has an incredible history of... It's at the foothill of Monte Grappa, where the famous spirit comes from. It was the front line in the First World War between Italy and Austria. In fact, the border until 1918 was only 1.5 kilometres from where I was born, and a bit further they speak German. Monte Grappa is where tens of thousands of soldiers of the Italian army and the Austria Habsburg. In fact, my father was a refugee, and in the Second World War is again the front line of the partisan and fighting the retreating Germans. And if you go to the cemetery, you'll find a great big reserved area with about 30 to 40 headstones, and you go into the photos of men and some young boys, 13, 14, and honoured a monument saying "Vittime del nazismo feroce," yes, victims of the ferocious Nazism. What happened was some general was shot while they were retreating, and my mother saw all this. They scoured through the town, picked every boy and man, lined them up, and had them all shot. And the strange thing is that within that town, there were pro-fascists and pro-partisans, and their children and that are still there. So it's a pleasant town and all this, but it has a history like most of Europe. Yeah. Anyway, we're running out of time.
Okay. Thank you very much, Angelo Grando, folks.
Oh, my pleasure.
It's been a buzz yet again, and next week we'll be back, Joe.
We'll be back. I haven't... sorted out a guest yet, but hopefully I'll find somebody. I'm sure there's somebody of slight interest out there we can talk to. But I don't think they'll be as exciting as Angela.
Oh, I'll come back. I'll have my own.
We have had one of Gary's guests come back, and sometimes I think it's once too often when you come back.
No, not necessarily. But anyway, folks, we'll catch you all next week. Pleasure.
Cross. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows. Everybody knows that the boat is leaking. Everybody knows the captain lied. Everybody got this broken feeling, like their father or their dog just died. Everybody talking to their pockets. Everybody wants a box of chocolates at the long stem road. Everybody knows. Everybody knows that you love me, baby. Everybody knows that you really do. Everybody knows that you've been faithful, give or take a night or two. Everybody knows.
Well, thank you for listening to that chat with Angelo, which was conducted by Gary Foley and myself. Angelo is a great human being, and it's important that we remember the people who've made a contribution to creating a better society in this country. Also, I'd like to thank Dale, our producer, in those early days, and Dale still does the Dogs program, if you're interested.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.